We don't have a quorum yet, but let's start the meeting.
Couple of announcements. Make sure your cell phones are turned off, members, please. And Ms. Holcomb sent you all an email about Health Partners winning a national award for their quality of health care, and sometime we're going to try to fit in a 20-minute or so hearing from Health Partners to talk about ways to improve quality and efficiency of health care. Today we're going to start off by hearing a presentation from the Park Nicollet Health Services, and David Abelson is here, I hope. And we all have copies of your PowerPoint. And would you please state your name for the tape?
Well, Mr. Chairman, thank you very much. I'm David Abelson. I'm the Chief Medical Information Officer at Park Nicollet. I also chair our Institute for Research and Education. I'm the former chair of the Institute for Clinical Systems Improvement, and I remain on the board of ICSI. What I'd like to do today is to talk about what Park Nicollet has learned as part of our demonstration project with CMS, particularly how this relates to disease management. And I want to describe part of our lessons learned about a fundamental constraint that we see in terms of the reimbursement model with preventing innovations in the area of disease management. And I'm actually going to refer to this as the tyranny of the visit. It's very simple, very basic, but a fundamental constraint. The tyranny of the visit is that when all is said and done, physicians and healthcare organizations on the clinic side are paid to see a patient face-to-face in a visit. And this generally precludes actually less expensive and more effective approaches to supporting individuals with disease management. So this will be, I think, a powerful lesson learned for us, and it's something that I want to share with you. And I also want to suggest that we have shown dramatic reductions in costs to Medicare, but because of this constraint, it is not sustainable or extendable to the rest of the country. So just a word about Park Nicollet. We are an integrated delivery system primarily in the West Metro area. Our flagship hospital is Methodist Hospital. We have 25 locations, about 8,100 employees, about 690 physicians. On the clinic side, we do about 2 million visits a year. We see about 500,000 individuals a year, and about 29,000 hospital admissions. We also have an institute for research and education. Our main method for improvement is using lean techniques from Toyota, and we've spent really the last 3 years immersed in that, and we're really beginning to see some results. So I'm going to actually begin with a thought question. I'm sure many of you are familiar with the RAND study by Elizabeth McGlynn, where McGlynn actually described that about half, that U.S. healthcare delivers about half of what we should in terms of either interventions or targets known to reduce morbidity and mortality. And it's a simple question, why is that? You know, what are some of the factors? And I think we all have a number of approaches and theories to that. I want to suggest that with individuals with chronic disease, the fundamental issue there is that all of us live with our health choices 8,760 hours per year. If we're basically healthy, then we are living with choices around how much do we exercise, how much do we sleep, how much do we eat. Increasingly, as we develop chronic diseases, we add choices around, do we see a physician? Are we able to see a physician? Do we take our medications? Do we adhere to other lifestyle changes? If you actually look at the typical individual with chronic disease, they generally spend about 2 to 3 hours per year in a physician's office. So it really begs the question, in those 2 hours that an individual with chronic disease sees a physician, what really happens that makes a difference, or what could happen that really makes a difference in the other 8,758 hours where the real work with chronic disease occurs? So one approach to supporting individuals with chronic disease outside of those 2 hours per year in the physician's office is what we call disease management. Disease management has a number of characteristics. There are usually evidence-based guidelines. There's generally a way to identify a population of people who have the problem. And there's generally specific support for self-management. It may be RNs in call centers. There's generally feedback and metrics about how we're doing. And so there's a fair amount that's known about disease management. Often disease management is done by carve-out vendors, and generally hired by health plans. And those carve-out vendors are actually not able to do what we did for CMS, in that we were able to have registered nurses actually follow protocols to deliver treatment. So with the usual carve-out disease management model, the vendors can actually not deliver any kind of care. As we look at disease management, in general, there is good evidence that disease management improves quality. There's actually very little evidence that it reduces costs. And so generally, the passion around disease management reducing costs outstrips the evidence. A lot of that is method. I think you'll see that we actually have a compelling case that it does reduce cost. It's actually somewhat similar to what you heard from the Duluth Clinic around congestive heart failure. So much of our knowledge about disease management is from the PGP, or Physician Group Practice Demonstration Project. We are one of 10 organizations across the country selected by CMS to look at ways of improving both efficiency and effectiveness. Other organizations are Geisinger, Billings, University of Michigan, Duke. So there are, again, 10 large organizations. It does include only the fee-for-service Medicare patients. And in order to qualify for a bonus based on quality, we actually have to create savings for Medicare. So it is different from other pay-for-performance programs in that it's not just quality. There's actually a need to reduce some costs. Our three-year demonstration project began in April of 2005. The pool of patients really includes all of our Medicare age fee-for-service. And as we look at the quality, that includes diabetes, prevention, coronary artery disease. But to create the savings of dollars, we focused on individuals with congestive heart failure, primarily because the best evidence for cost savings with disease management are with individuals with congestive heart failure. Those individuals are at very high risk for hospitalization. Congestive heart failure is a condition where the heart does not pump as vigorously as it should. Fluid backs up, and unless people stay on a strict regimen of low salt and following their medications, they reaccumulate the fluid and end up in the hospital. The general hospitalization rate is 2 to 3 times a year across the country for individuals with congestive heart failure. 50 to 80% of those are avertable if people stick with their regimen. So what we did was implemented a very simple system where people went to Costco. If they didn't have a scale at their home, they have a regular scale. And once a day, they go to their phones, they dial up a number, and they punch in their weight, and they answer 4 questions. Are you short of breath? Do you have any swelling of your ankles? If their weight is up, or if any of those questions are changed, we actually have four case managers who contact them and then follow protocols to increase their water pill or at times hold their water pill. I'll show you the data, but basically for each dollar that we spend on this program for the software and for the case managers, we save CMS $6. And that is primarily through averted hospitalizations. So this is a graph of our averted hospitalizations of Methodist Hospital for individuals with congestive heart failure. This is actually a calculated number. So the evidence is full of all kinds of calculated numbers, and people end up criticizing this kind of number because of selection bias. They say, well, maybe the people enrolled in the program are healthier than those that aren't. So I'll show you some more compelling data in a minute, but just following this, we average about 50 averted hospitalizations a month at about $6,000 hospitalization. So that actually averages out to about one averted admission per enrollee per year. If we extended that nationally, that would have massive implications in terms of CMS costs. This number cannot be criticized from the point of view of selection bias. This number actually represents the total discharges from Methodist Hospital, regardless of whether somebody is enrolled on the program or not. We were averaging about 203, and we're bouncing now between about 150 to 180 discharges a month. An important number to look at are people with congestive heart failure who are admitted and then readmitted within 30 days. The red line is in 2005. The yellow line is in 2006, and so you can see a clear separation in our numbers. And the impact is from the congestive heart failure hypertelligence program. As we look at the total, at the percent of total admissions at Methodist Hospital that are due to congestive heart failure, the top line represents 2005. It was anywhere from 8 to 9%, and we are now at about 6 to 7%. So our overall admissions have dropped as a percentage. Now, all of this has occurred while as the number of individuals at Park Nicollet with congestive heart failure has actually increased. So we've had a 14.3% increase in the number of people who have congestive heart failure, but despite that overall increase, our discharge, our rate, in other words, people admitted to Methodist, has gone down considerably. This is just a screenshot of the kind of software that people can use on the web if they so choose instead of using a phone. We only have 7 patients out of 650 that use a web view for that, and I suspect those are mainly the children of the patients. So that's all of the good news. Again, about $6 saved for every dollar spent. This is, I think, a program that could easily be extended across the country and could be extended to other conditions, but we can't because of what I call the tyranny of the visit. Tyranny of the visit, all is said and done, we get paid for a physician seeing a patient face-to-face in a room. There are generally not adequate payment for case managers doing this kind of work, for actually support of individuals by people other than a physician who costs less money, who can actually do a better job once the diagnosis and treatment plan is set up. There's actually a study about guidelines. A lot of people say, well, the reason why McGlynn found that half the people don't get the care that they need is because docs don't follow guidelines. They're actually... two studies that asked an interesting question. If we took a panel of 2,500 patients in family medicine and said, how long would it take for that family doc to meet all of the preventive care guidelines, was actually article number one. Article number two said, how long would it take for that doc to meet all of the guidelines for chronic disease. And so they modeled the practice with X number of people with high blood pressure, Y number with diabetes. And what they found was that it would take a doctor 10.6 hours per day just to meet the chronic disease guidelines. It would take 7.4 hours for the preventive care, so counseling, tobacco cessation, breast examinations, pap smears. They were already spending 4.6 hours on acute, so it averaged 22.6 hours a day. The good news was this was only 5 days a week, so it does leave the weekend. This is based on the tyranny of the visit, where all of the care to do this was by a physician face-to-face in an office visit, because that mirrors how most care is paid for. So this is another shot, another way of saying the same thing. If we look at a big pie chart of the patient's life, we have 8,758 hours per year. 2 hours of that is spent with an MD, and our entire reimbursement model on the clinic is focused on that. I want to make it clear that when I talk about the need to change the reimbursement model so we can begin to do more effective interventions for disease management, I am not saying we have to increase the outlay of dollars. I'm saying we need to extend what we pay for to forms of support that actually cost less money than our current method, have the potential for saving more dollars and are likely more effective. And it's often registered nurses following protocols once a diagnosis is made, once the treatment plan is instituted. We actually have a paradox with our success in that we have actually shown significant improvement in quality and in cost. In our case, we have a projected loss of doing this of $7 million a year. That's $750,000 for direct costs. And then the incentives are so perverse in our current model that we actually are losing 6.25 in lost revenue. Now, that's a good thing. I'm not here to say we need that lost revenue made up, but I'm using this as an example, really a poster child of the current perverse incentives that need to be changed so that we can begin to apply known effective interventions. We actually are able to do this because the PGP demonstration project gives us the opportunity to at least make up for the lost direct costs that we are incurring. So, in conclusion, disease management is clearly the right thing to do. There's good evidence that improves quality. Individuals with chronic disease do the hard work on their own, at home, at work, at school. We need to find better ways of supporting those individuals other than 2 or 3 office hours with a physician, where the physician is worried about a lot of other things with the patient. Our current disease management model, particularly the vendor-centric model, actually responds to the tyranny of the visit. So basically, since CMS and the plans don't pay for anything other than a doc seeing a patient, the plans have set up call centers of RNs to help support individuals with chronic disease. In general, a good thing, but it has the potential to actually fragment care further. It's just one more entity. And those call center RNs cannot actually deliver care. So they can't follow protocols like we have for the diuretics. I think it is important that the support for individuals be part of actually the treatment plan. And delivery systems have the ability to do that. And again, the main theme is that our current economic model is not sustainable to do the kind of quality improvement and efficiency that we need, and we have to begin to address the tyranny of the visit so that we can use less expensive and more effective care, particularly for individuals with chronic disease. So that's what we've learned. I'd be happy if we have time to field any questions.
Dr. Abelson, could you expand a little bit on the difference between nurses hired by the clinic doing this versus nurses from a call center, which is not directly related to the patient?
There are a couple of issues there. As you know, many of the plans have hired companies. There are call centers. The good news with those is that they can offer some counseling to patients. But generally, if there's any intervention that's required, like you need to increase your insulin dose, or you need a blood test, or you need to increase your diuretic, they end up faxing that information to the care team. That's information that's out of context. And more often than not, if you talk with clinicians, it's not acted on, not because of lack of intent, but because it's just fragmented and it just appears to come out of nowhere. So that's issue number one of increasing the fragmentation. Issue number two is that since they're not part of a delivery system, they cannot use protocols to deliver care. And some of the most effective support for disease management actually occurs when registered nurses are able to say, yes, this person fits the criteria that have been set up, and I have these orders that apply to this patient to increase their water pill, increase their insulin, increase their asthma medication, whatever it is. So it's what the delivery systems can do is tighten the link between supporting the individual, finding out what's going on in a way outside of the visit, and actually changing therapy.
And how much does CMS let you keep of the savings that you make? Because they have pilots out now that are letting clinics keep 85% of potential savings.
The way it works is that we first have to create a bonus pool. The bonus pool is defined by our rate of increase being at least 2% less than our competitors. So for the first 2% of savings, we get zero. So that is a problem. We are then able to earn up to 85% of the savings between 2% and 5%. So there is a 5% cap on that.
Representative Abler.
Thanks. Since there's not much time, but I just wanted to ask a couple questions. We had a similar presentation from St. Mary's from Duluth. I'm glad it's just not the lake area that helps. So it's nice that it can be done in an urban setting as well. But is this only a Medicare thing, or do you do this with medical assistance patients too?
Another reason why we chose congestive heart failure is because we could apply this intervention to every individual with that condition. So one of our values is that we don't segregate care by payer type. We don't stratify by payer type. 85% of this population are Medicare age, so we felt that that was a reasonable trade-off, that we could target the care to the full population, but yet still, most of it would be CMS and counted for that. Another issue that we learned is if we have to end up stratifying our care processes by payer type, that adds complexity to us and ultimately adds cost. So whenever we add complexity, we add cost. So it's very important that we have incentives in general that allow organizations to deliver the best care that is not stratified by payer type.
Mr. Representative, where I'm going with that in brief, it seems like if we can't do much about CMS, and probably who can, but the medical assistance world, the Minnesota care world, we can do something about that, and it seems that we could put something in place even this session with our good brains we have here to push what we can to deliver on our own programs toward that direction, and maybe that's someplace we should try to go yet this session.
Representative Abler, there will be some bills shortly to do that. And actually, the governor's got a little bit in his budget as well. Representative Gottwald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Real quickly, Does this suggest a change in the rugs or the categories? I mean, you mentioned the fact that you've got the tyranny of the visit and how reimbursement is funneled through that. Do we need to change who we're reimbursing and what we're reimbursing them for? And if so, where are those proposals at?
We are actually working with CMS on a proposal to extend the demonstration project. And the model we're looking at is actually payment for a condition or a payment for actually managing this. So right now, we have basically accepted risk on the entire Medicare population with no data to manage it compared to our competitors. And we don't want to do that. We want to be able to say we can get these outcomes for people with congestive heart failure and we can do it in general at this cost, and to have a payment that is linked to a condition. So it's more similar to episodes. We are beginning to work with some of the plans on some creative experiments around the equivalent of paying for specific episodes of care.
Thank you. Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Doctor, one is a request, and that I'd really be interested in if you'd be or your staff would be willing to take the time to compare some of your work with that of St. Mary's in Duluth that we heard about earlier, because while you're using an off-the-shelf scale and trusting people to take accurate measurements and convey it, the Duluth model was actually using a very expensive piece of technology to do the weighing and to ask the questions. And I think sometimes we go to technology without really knowing whether it adds value, and I'd love to see that impact. But I'd also like you to once again tell us what the difference was of the 650 people, how many people use the web-based interaction, because I think there's an assumption that web-based things will be the key to this serving this generation, and I'm not sure it is.
Well, we would be delighted to talk with the SMDC. I actually have a contact, so I'd love to do it within this group. We're going to do it anyways on our own. I want to remind people that I'm the Chief Medical Information Officer at Park Nicollet, so
yeah.
My job is supposedly high-tech. And what really attracted us to this health insurance was how amazingly low-tech it was. If a person had a phone and a scale, that was enough. And the important thing is that with a scale is that it just be consistent from day to day because you're looking at change. And so I agree completely about looking first at low-tech solutions. Out of our 650 people, we have all but six using the phone, and six are using the web. And my case managers tell me that several of those six are actually kids that are adult children who are doing it for their parents.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Dr. Abelson, for your great testimony, and we'll be following up with you and St. Mary's and hopefully some other groups that come here and talk about changing the payment system. So thank you for your testimony. I will now call the meeting to order. And we have a quorum, and Representative Tremba is going to move the minutes, right?
So moved. I was so enthralled with the last comments, I lost it.
So the minutes have been moved. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The minutes are adopted, and I'm now going to turn it over to Representative Koch to run the meeting.
Yeah. Representative Huntley moves House File 782 for possible inclusion into the omnibus bill. Representative Huntley, to your bill.
Mr. Chair and members, over the past 4 or 5 years, we've reduced payments to hospitals by significant amounts, probably totaling about $290 million over the the past years. What this bill does is restore all those cuts on July 1 of this year. Obviously, there's a fiscal note, you need to know and keep in mind what we've done over the last 4 or 5 years, which has reduced what we pay for medical assistance, GAMC, and Minnesota Care, two hospitals for both inpatient and outpatient care, and the net has been about $293. There is a fiscal note, as you might suspect. And I think Mary Krinke from the Hospital Association will discuss that fiscal note. We think it's a little higher than it ought to be. The fiscal note is about $125 million per biennium. We think it's not that big. The Department of Finance counted some things that this bill does not do. And you need to understand that for most of these patients, not all, GAMC, there's no federal match, but when we cut to save ourselves money by not paying the hospitals as much as we used to, they not only don't get the money that we would have paid them, but they also don't get the federal match, which is usually dollar for dollar. So a $293 million cut is nearly $600 million in cuts to what they get paid. And with that, I would invite some people down to testify.
Mr. Chairman and members, my name is Mary Braddock, and I'm just getting used to these, so if I waver, it's because I'm at that age where they're sometimes necessary and sometimes not. And I am a pediatrician at Children's Hospitals and Clinics of Minnesota, where I also serve as the Director of Child Health Policy. My organization includes two acute care hospitals, Children's Minneapolis and Children's St. Paul, where we admit more than 13,000 children each year. On behalf of the Minnesota Hospital Association and its 135 member hospitals, I am here today to thank Representative Huntley and the other co-authors of this bill and to express our strong support for House File 782. The bill proposes to end on July 1st of 2007 a portion of the hospital rate cuts which were instituted in 2002, 2003, and 2005. These rate cuts have been cumulative, and when added together, represent an 11.5% cut to hospital payment rates when serving those patients who are admitted to our hospitals as inpatients. These cuts were not discrete, one-time cuts, but continue on into the future. If state legislators do not act this year to reduce any of the rate cuts, Minnesota's hospitals will experience more than $235 million in payment reductions in the 2008 and 9 biennium. This particular legislation would end cuts in the medical assistance fee-for-service program, which represents about 40% of the cuts that have been made to hospitals. Cuts would remain in place for patients who are covered by prepaid medical assistance program, the General Assistance Medical Care Program, and by Minnesota Care. The cuts in medical assistance payments have been particularly hard on children's hospitals because we serve a disproportionate number of children who are enrolled in medical assistance, children from around the state. At my own organization, 49% of our beds are critical care, meaning that we serve the sickest children and babies, and yet 37% of our revenue comes from the medical assistance program, meaning that this revenue is critical to all the care we provide, regardless of whether the patients are covered by medical assistance or not. Today, payment cuts to Children's Hospitals and Clinics of Minnesota have totaled over $32 million. This has had a negative impact on our service 3. For example, We have not implemented an expanded hospitalist program as planned. This has been shown in other communities to improve care. We have delayed portions of our electronic health record implementation, and we have postponed indefinitely a program designed to address childhood obesity, which unfortunately, as we all know, in the long run, would save money for patients and the communities that serve them. Because of the high volume of patients we serve in the medical assistance program, about 15% of the total cuts to hospitals have been borne by the state's three independent children's hospitals. The more patients a hospital serves who are enrolled in Minnesota's public health programs, the more that hospital has been hurt by these cuts. Without some increase in reimbursement rates, in 2007, Children's is projecting nearly $20 million in costs over payments for serving individuals enrolled in our public health care programs. Simply stated, the current situation is not sustainable as we continue each year to serve a greater and greater proportion of children enrolled in the state's medical assistance programs. And some of these data are illustrated in PowerPoint slides 9 and 10 in one of your handouts. Because of the dollar-for-dollar federal match in the medical assistance program, whatever lawmakers can do to end at least a portion of the cuts that have been made will be very helpful to all members of the hospital community and ultimately to the patients we serve. Thank you so much for your consideration of this legislation.
Thank you, Dr. Brad. Any questions?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Mary Krinke, and I'm with the Minnesota Hospital Association. I would like to just draw your attention to a couple charts that we have provided you in your packets of information. A picture is worth a thousand words, and some of what I'm going to be saying reiterates what Dr. Braddock said, but I think it will make the point on a couple issues. The first chart that I'd like for you to look at is the one called Hospital Payment Cuts. It's multicolored, and you should be able to spot it pretty quickly. I just want to look at the four different colors that are shown here. The little tiny bit of purple at the bottom was the 0.5% cut that was made in the 2002 session, and that was to our medical assistance and Minnesota Care programs. Then the burgundy color is the 5% rate cut that was made in our Minnesota Care and Medical Assistance Program in the 2003 session. The little bit of yellow there is the General Assistance 10% cut that was made in the 2003 session. And then the light blue cut is the 6% cut that was made in the 2005 session. And I don't expect you all to know all the numbers here, but the bottom line is that the cuts are cumulative, and one cut was made piling on top of the other cut. And they go out into the future unless the legislature takes action. So if you look at the projections for 2008 and 2009, all those cuts will be in place, and the total will be about $235 million to the hospital community for the four cuts that are in place. I saw a question, but...
Thank you, Ms. Krinke. Representative Gottwald.
Thank you, Mr. Vice Chair. I this is a great idea. And, some might question the dollar amount. Fastest growing part of our state budget right now, and we're trying to find ways to cut health care costs. But when we take these cuts year after year, who makes up for these bars? I'd like the testifiers to comment, if they could, about the phenomenon known as cost shifting.
Well, Representative Gottwald and Mr. Chairman, the hospital either goes broke or they raise the rates to everybody else. And by and large, that's what happens. They raise the rates to the rest of us. So while we may see savings in the state budget, first of all, the hit's doubled because of the medical assistance federal match that's lost. And what the hospitals have to do is raise the rates to people that have insurance.
Representative Bunn.
Thank you, Chair Hush and testifiers. I had a broader historical question regarding this, since many of us are new to this committee and to the legislature. In terms of the, so Representative Huntley, you might want to address this, in terms of the rationale for these various cuts, I assume that most, if not all, were because of the overall dire situation with the budget deficit. But if that was the case, I might have expected to maybe see some sunset studying involved in some of these. So I'd like you to explain if that was indeed the case with each of these cuts, and if not, what other rationale was presented at the time.
The rationale was we had to balance the budget, and this was the choice that was made. There was no sunset put in any of these, so they were intended to go on until if some future legislature like this one hopefully could make a change.
Members of the committee, this is just a comment that I would like to share. Plugging in a rate cut is one of the simplest things to do. You get out your calculator, you plug in the rate cut, and you can come up with a savings of dollars. What you all are attempting to do this year and the presentations that Chairman Huntley has had, you're looking at trying to save the healthcare system dollars by reform and making change. The cuts that were made were really just shifting who paid. They didn't help reduce healthcare costs. So I think the work that you are attempting to do this year is very sound. So.
Thank you, Ms. Krenke. If we can continue with the testimony.
I'd like next to draw your attention to the second chart that we provided. This is on the back side, the flip side of the chart that's called Helping Our Hospitals Help Their Communities. And I'm not going to go through this whole handout. I just want you to look at the pie chart. And trust me, I don't like to correct Representative Huntley, but he said that this legislation was buying back all the cuts that are made. And in reality, the legislation only proposes to buy back the light blue section of the cuts that have been made. Cuts have been made in the medical assistance prepaid medical assistance program. That's in the purple, and that represents about 39% of the cuts that have been made to hospitals. There have been cuts that have been made to GAMC and cuts that have been made to Minnesota Care. And the bill that is before you today, House File 782, proposes to eliminate by July 1, 2007, the cuts that have been made in the fee-for-service portion of our medical assistance programs. And there's a rationale behind why we chose this approach. I know everyone here is very concerned about trying to expand eligibility in our Minnesota Care program. So we thought it would be kind of counterproductive for us to try to get our rates restored in the Minnesota Care program. At the same time, legislators are trying to expand access to care in our Minnesota Care program. So we thought, well, let's just leave those cuts in place for now. The General Assistance Medical Care Program has no federal participation. So if the state restores a dollar of cuts in GAMC, we don't get the match. So it's a lot more cost effective to restore the dollars that have been cut in the medical assistance program so we get the dollar for dollar match. And likewise, the cuts that have been made in the prepaid medical assistance program, that money would go through the health plans. And so the providers may get a portion of it, but it's an indirect reimbursement rather than a direct reimbursement. So buying back the cuts or ending the cuts that have happened in the fee-for-service portion of the cuts is the most direct way to help the hospital community. And if I may, Mr. Chairman, I just have one other chart that I would like to show you that's in your packet. This is one regarding uncompensated care and emergency room trends. This is the black and white one. And it's really not part of the reimbursement or direct cuts that have been made. But the cuts that have been made in eligibility have increased the volumes of uncompensated care that the hospitals are seeing. And these really are pretty dramatic numbers over just a two-year period. From 2003 to 2004, hospitals saw a 25% increase in their uncompensated care. And from 2004 to 2005, we saw a 28% drop in increase in our uncompensated care. And if you look at the trend in people showing up at the emergency room because they don't have health insurance, they don't know where else to turn, we are seeing a huge increase in the number of visits to our hospital emergency rooms. So this bill doesn't directly impact that, but I think it's important for everyone to understand what the hospitals are facing right now.
Thank you, Ms. Prinke. Can't see you over there. And I believe we have one other testifier, Mr. McAfee.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Mark McAfee, representing AFSCME Council 5. We're the Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, and we represent a number of health care workers in Minnesota. We have folks who work in nursing homes. We have folks that work for Department of Human Services. And in this case, we have a number of folks that work in hospitals such as Regents Hospital, Fairview University, Hennepin County Medical Center. I won't reiterate a lot of the points that were so ably made by Representative Huntley and Ms. Krinke and Dr. Braddock. It just makes, if we pause and think back over what we've gone through in the budget deficits, many of the people in this room, at least sitting up in the two sides, spent hours and hours, those that were working on behalf of the healthcare industry, sitting through hearings as Health and Human Services really took it on the chin as we worked to balance the budget. So it's great that we were able to come back from $4 billion down, but we must remind ourselves that was sustained in part by doing it on the backs of hospitals for a period, nursing homes, and other institutions. So we know that there's a hefty fiscal note with this, but there may be an even bigger one down the line if nothing is done. So we salute Representative Huntley for bringing this bill forward. Something needs to be done this year in the area of hospitals, and we encourage you to do that. So we support House File 782 as a step towards it. Thank you, and I will end and answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. McAfee. Any questions, Representative Abler? Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Chairman Hush. Representative Huntley, I have forgotten, but does the governor, if he does anything to about this rate problem we're having?
There's nothing in the governor's budget that addresses this problem. Yeah.
Nothing yet.
Representative Huntley, you did note earlier that you had some questions on the fiscal note and some inclusion of some of the fiscal impacts on that. Do you want somebody from the department to address that?
Why don't we have Mary Prinke talk about that? We, you know, this is going to be laid on the table, and we can negotiate with the department over the true fiscal note.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Mary Prinke again. For the record, the fiscal note includes buying back benefits in general assistance medical care, and it also includes a 1% buyback to the managed care plans, and that is not part of this legislation. So I think it was just a technical error. We need to get with the department and work that out, and there's just a few little mistakes in it. We think it's been overstated. So we'll try to get the committee a revised fiscal note as soon as we can.
Thank you, Ms. Prinke. Representative Abler.
Thank you. Ms. Prinke, can I stay there? I got a question. Nice to have your bill here. It's, have you talked to the chair of the committee? Is he favorable to this bill? Have you found that out or not? Could you help me with history a little bit? I sat through all these cuts, and it wasn't a very fun time at all. And Chair Huntley sat through them, too, and made some of the same comments he's making today. But at the time we were talking about this, it was unclear to us the impact of these rate cuts, because there was other monies that were going to backfill. There was some dish money. There's a bunch of other stuff, and not to minimize the presentations, that's valid, and I signed the bill, and so I agree. But was there some other, because we never knew how much it got, you know, and it was this magic curtain we couldn't see. So were there other things that went up in this time that you could comment about just to help us get the big picture? Because I thought there was some there were some coverage changes about who had, we got rid of a cap on certain groups and that whole thing. Can you talk about that at least for 30 seconds?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Abler, this is one of the issues that we are going to be dealing with this session. I might as well get it on the table for you all. It's called disproportionate share hospital money. And there was allocations from the federal government that gave Minnesota additional DISH money. Everything has to have an abbreviation, you all. So disproportionate share hospital money is referred to as DISH. And basically the federal government said that the states could leverage additional DISH money if they could put up matching funds in order to get that additional DISH money. We were trying, as Representative Abler said, to offset some of these cuts with additional money from the federal government. Our leveraging mechanism that we used was through certified public expenditures. And Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services, CMS, has recently published a rule that would disallow certified public expenditures. So our ability to leverage additional DISH money is up in the air right now, Representative Abler. So we may have to go back in and work on how we can get that additional DISH money. So you are correct in saying that we were trying to mitigate some of the impact of these cuts with DISH money, but that hasn't happened yet.
Okay. Ms. Pinky, that wasn't a setup.
Because
I know there were, because we sat and we agonized about this. This was the first 4 years of my term were way more fun than that interim time, I'll have to tell you. And just to clarify one thing, then I have one more question. On the big sheet you have here, helping our hospitals, the mention was about the matching money doubles it, but the $293 includes the match, is that correct?
Yes.
Okay, so that's better than that. 6/10 of a billion. And then one final question, which may not surprise you, on your uncompensated care sheet. And again, the magic curtain of trying to clarify. We spent some time in our division, I think last year, trying to get our arms around what this term uncompensated care means. Can you tell me, because we said, is this the cost of services? And sometimes in Medicaid systems, our services are below cost, and being paid actually results in a loss. Getting nothing that you think you're going to get results in a loss, like a bad debt. Is that based on retail? And so can you, and there's also community benefit, which this probably does not include, but can you comment on what basis these numbers are on? Are they, how you help me interpret that?
My understanding, these on that chart with the gray bars,
yeah.
Those numbers are based on payments in relation to charges. Okay. Now the health department just issued a report a month ago, I guess now, and they have some of different numbers they used. They went at it with a different approach, and where these are saying close to $400 million in losses, the health department said it was closer to $200 million, and the difference is that the Department of Health's numbers looked at did not take into account the fact that medical assistance does not pay the cost of that care. But later in the Department of Health's report, they attempted to add that back in at the end, but if they got paid 50% of what it costs, the health department says they got paid. So the numbers aren't quite the same between this and the other report, and we can all get into long arguments about charges and costs, and it's like you get on an airplane with 200 people and all 200 are paid a different amount of money for their ticket, so it's very hard to say what it is, but I think the Department of Health, you can easily take their as the minimum of about $200 million.
And Mr. Chair, Representative Aples, Chair, and Mr. Chair. And I'm sympathetic to the problem. We've struggled with this discussion because it's like a lot and a lot more, and so I thought that we had succeeded last year in having terms based upon cost. And I don't care what the answer is. I just would hope that I want to be sympathetic to your plight here and be able to at least know how bad the problem is, and I still don't feel like I've gotten it.
Mr. Chair, Representative Abler, uncompensated care is defined as a combination of charity care and bad debt. And it has to be calculated on our costs, not on our charges. In the report that was recently done by the Department of Health, they got everyone to do it based on their charges, based on their costs. And when our report came out, we had a few of our members who mistakenly did it to their charges. But the rules for governance on this is it's bad debt, charity care, and charity care based on the provision of care to your costs, not to your charges.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Huntley or Ms. Krenke, we're asking for more money to offset these cuts, and as Representative Gottwell just said, there was a cost shifting that was done to make up the difference of the cuts that were. Where do we get the money, or how does it affect the rest of health care if we put this into play? Does it have a major overall effect on the health care system?
Well,
by putting this in effect?
Mr. Chair and Representative Anderson, it's sort of back to the payment reform. And one of the worst things about our system is that we have all these transfers of costs around in the system. And because we don't, for instance, they lose money on, hospitals lose money on OB. Okay, so what do? They raise their rates someplace else in the system. And it would make a lot more sense if we just paid hospitals for OB what it costs them to do OB, so we don't have this cost shifting back and forth. And what they do if we don't pay the full cost for medical assistance, they raise the rates to everybody else, and it just distorts the whole system. So any step that we can take that reduces the cost shifting will result in a better, more effective marketplace.
So, Mr. Chair, Representative Huntley, will putting this money back in, you're asking for $54 million for fiscal year 08, will that help to stop the cost shifting?
It will certainly help to reduce cost shifting. I suppose if you're asking, will they reduce their charges to everybody else by $54 million? And, I don't know.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Anderson. We do have four additional questions in line, and we have another bill that needs to be here today, so if we can try to make them quick. Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Huntley or Ms. Krenke, what is the reform bill that we should accomplish here? Because I think this is still a Band-Aid, and I hear rate reform or other reform. What is it we should really be working on so that we don't temporarily camouflage what the true costs are?
Ms. Krenke.
Mr. Chair, Representative Erickson, that is somewhat of the $6 million question for this legislative session. But clearly, when government underpays providers for serving those on our government health care programs, and clearly you all have to decide who's eligible, and that makes some sense. You all have that discussion of who all's eligible for our health care programs. But once you decide who's eligible, providers need to be paid close to their costs of providing that service, or that cost is then shifted to our private payers, and we see increases in our premium costs for everyone else. And it is contributing to the rising cost of health care. I think one of the things that this committee needs to struggle with is how do you look at health care reform that saves money and not just shifting who pays. And the Hospital Association is working on ideas regarding administrative simplification that we're working on to save money. I know Representative Huntley is working on these kind of the testimony that you've heard from SMDC as well as from Park Nicollet today. How can we deliver services more effectively and efficiently? So it's the combination of working on access and payment at the same time you try to bring reform to the system, and it's tough. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Liebling.
Chances that we won't. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, a lot of my questions have been answered in the discussion, and I just want to say that I think this is a very important issue, and I sure hope we can find the dollars to do it.
Representative Bunn.
Yes, thank you, Chair. On this issue of cost shifting, I understood your explanation of the pie chart from the point of view of your association and getting the most kind of bang for the buck for a given amount of a relief. But I am concerned that, once again, it's reinstating rates in one part of the system but not in the other parts of the system, the fee for service but not in the Minnesota Care GMAC PMAP. And I'm concerned about what that's going to do in terms of how you're treating populations from those different groups, or again, differential impacts on them because, once again, we're tinkering in a not consistent way across the system.
That's an interesting question, Mr. Chair and Representative Bunn. And the vast majority of people on medical assistance are in PMAP. Mm-hmm. Okay, and most of the people that are in fee for service are people with disabilities. And so you're looking at a smaller population, but with very high costs. And yeah, you are correct. It doesn't solve the whole problem, but it's a step in the right direction.
Thank you. If there's no further questions, and if there's no objection, then House File 782 will be laid over for possible inclusion to the Health and Human Services Omnibus Bill.
The next bill on the agenda is House File 570, Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I move that House File 570 be laid over for possible inclusion in the Health and Human Services Omnibus Bill.
The bill's been moved for possible inclusion.
Thank you very much. I ask for your support today for this legislation for Bethesda Hospital in St. Paul, which is the only nonprofit licensed long-term care hospital in the state. This bill eliminates the ratable reductions for Bethesda Hospital. Bethesda is known as a state resource for its brain injury services, including the NBI unit, a respiratory care unit that successfully weans patients, often with spinal cord injuries, off their ventilators, and a medical behavioral unit that has a locked and unlocked unit for geriatric patients that are either a danger to themselves or others, or can't be managed in a skilled nursing facility or in their home. Bethesda provides care for an average of 125 patients a day, or roughly 1,400 patients a year. Long-term care hospitals provide a unique set of services for patients in Minnesota. Patients can't be admitted to a hospital unless the expected length of stay is 25 days. Bethesda's average length of stay is 33 days. I want to let you know that I support the bill that we just heard. I think it's an important piece of legislation that it deals with the issue that I'm talking about in this bill. And both that bill and this one are critical to ensuring the neural brain injury unit at Bethesda will remain open. I want to introduce to you Dr. Carroll, who will provide some brief testimony about the three different brain injury services at Bethesda, and Brian Johnson, who will review the information in your packet detailing the impact of the ratable reductions and losses under medical assistance. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. I'm Dr. Bob Carroll. I'm a neuropsychologist, meaning I'm a psychologist that specializes in folks that have had brain injury. I have been working at Bethesda, which is up the street, for about 14 years now, working with folks that have had brain injury. And as I sat here today listening to people, the statistics, I also have some statistics for you. But those of you who have seen me present before know I'm a fairly passionate kind of guy. And for me, brain injury means a lot because these are folks who can't advocate for themselves because they have memory deficits and they have distractibility problems and they have reasoning problems and they've had brain damage. So this is personal for me because I feel very strongly for folks that can't advocate for themselves. At Bethesda, we have three brain injury programs. We have a brain injury rehabilitation program, which is for people mostly who've had new, fresh brain damage, and we're rehabilitating them to get back into the community. We also have a neurobehavioral crisis and assessment program for people with brain injuries who are in emotional and behavioral crisis, and need out of wherever they are at the moment, be it home or another facility, for short-term stabilization. But the program I mostly want to talk about is our long-term program, the Neurobehavioral Brain Injury Program, that we've been running out for about 14 years. This is a program designed for people who are dangerous to themselves or dangerous to other people and have had brain damage. Most of the brain damage has occurred from trauma, car accidents, falls, assaults, other sorts of things. So most of it's traumatic brain injury. Mm-hmm. Previous to the opening of our program, these folks were being sent out of state, out of Minnesota, actually to a facility that used to exist in Massachusetts. That program is now defunct and has been closed for years and years now. We're spending tax dollars out of state. Providers lost track of their patients. Families were separated. Follow-up care was not very good. And the Department of Human Services approached Bethesda, and Bethesda worked with the Department of Human Services to put together this program to serve people in Minnesota who are dangerous to themselves and other people. And by dangerous to themselves and other people, I mean these are folks that would be threatening to kill themselves, threatening to kill other people, burning down buildings, assaulting their pregnant mother, having fights with the police. These are people who are truly dangerous. This program is designed to take care of everybody else's treatment failures. The easy cases where behavior was a problem are treated elsewhere. The easy cases can be handled by lots of different people. This program is designed to take everybody else's outliers. To give you a sense of how big the problem is, and I think I'm passionate about everybody with a disability, and so I don't mean to put down any other disability group, but it's hard for people to understand how many people are having brain injuries. You hear numbers thrown around about 100,000, 10,000. Those numbers don't mean anything anymore. If you add up all the people every year in the United States that have breast cancer, and you add to that all the people in the United States every year that have spinal cord injury, and you add to that all the new cases of AIDS and HIV, and you add to that all the cases of multiple sclerosis, brain injury is 6 times that number added together. There is a huge epidemic going on among about brain injury, and nobody talks about it. The Brain Injury Association of Minnesota and the Brain Injury Association of America refer to it as the silent epidemic. Now, Bethesda is obviously not treating all of these folks, and the program I'm talking about is taking a small subset of the people who no one else can care for. Our program, this program I'm talking about, has an average length of stay of 238 days, although people could be there up to 2 years, perhaps. And the problem, the reason the length of stay is so long, is we have to individualize treatment for each person to figure out how to get them back into the community. If it was a canned cookie-cutter approach, somebody else would have come up with it before. The treatment method we have devised is so innovative that the publisher, CRC Press, which publishes medical textbooks, has published a book about the Bethesda model and the Bethesda treatment program. This is a huge national publisher. We are doing unique work here. We get 85% of our referrals from other hospitals. This means, again, we're taking their outliers into our program. And we are very successful at this. Some of our people go home. Most of them go to group homes. They return to work. They have a social life. They're productive members of society. And again, you have to remember the severity of the people we're taking. Our nurses get broken arms. They get broken noses. They're hit. They're spit. They're kicked on, and we continue to work with these people day after day, month after month, and we successfully get them into the community. How important is this? Some interesting statistics have just come out recently. The Minnesota Business Plan for Ending Long-Term Homelessness, which I assume many of you are familiar with, quotes that they believe 31% of people that are homeless in Minnesota have had brain injuries. There's a study now going on with the Department of Corrections in Minnesota screening people newly admitted into the Minnesota prison system. They are finding that 90% of new admits to the Minnesota prison system have had at least one brain injury. 60% have had two or more. So if you ask me what happens if our program goes away, I'll tell you what's going to happen. These are people, without us, who would end up in the state hospitals, who would end up in prison, who would end up homeless, and that's not what's happening to the people we're treating. Those are the people that I feel passionate about. We're doing remarkable work with them. And so I want you to have a sense of how crucial this work is. And I'll turn it over to Brian, who will talk with you about the numbers.
Good afternoon. My name is Brian Johnson. I'm the finance director at Bethesda. And I thank you for the opportunity to speak in front of you today. The file that was introduced just before us, 782, is essentially, this is our proposal here for 570 is more of a safety net because, as Dr. Carroll mentioned, Bethesda's program for the traumatic brain injury was set up with a partnership with the state of Minnesota. And then since the ratable reductions went into place, which are on the first handout that you should have in your packet with the two yellow lines across it, since those reductions went into place, the payments have been falling behind what the cost is, has been, just like everybody else. What we're trying to do, and working with the Department of Human Services, is try to get the payments caught up to this program, as any partner should, any partnership should. So that is the first part of what we're trying to ask for today, is to at least get the ratable reductions added back for Bethesda Hospital. The second part of our language today is to try to put in place more of the safety net for the DISH payment, which was also introduced as part of 782, just for Bethesda. I know the dollar amount that in 782 is a huge dollar amount, and all we're asking to do is, as you can see on the other handout, on the second page, it shows with one yellow line, most of the patients that fall into Dr. Carroll's program fall into what's called DRG 429, which is for organic disturbance and mental retardation. We're not asking the state to cover our overall loss in shortage. What we're trying to do is just get this program caught back up. And the dollar amount is not that high. It's about $150,000. And that would get the combination of these two paragraphs would get Bethesda caught back up to what the cost is for running this program. I thank you.
Good questions. Representative Gottwald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Murphy, is there a fiscal note on this?
Mr. Chair.
Murphy.
Representative Gottwald. Hi. I have to say that my understanding of the creation of fiscal notes at this point is sort of like my understanding of the selection of a pope. So I've requested one. It's not ready, but my understanding is that it's about $150,000 a year for the biennium.
Representative Gowell, we have requested a fiscal note on this bill, and it's in process, and we'll be here shortly. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Dr. Carroll, I am just astounded by your numbers for traumatic brain injury, and I wonder if you could just talk about that a little bit more. What's included in that? And I'm also astounded. I sit on the Public Safety Finance Committee also, where we talk a lot about who's going to prison and why they're in prison and what we can do about that. And so your numbers about how many of those people have traumatic brain injuries, that's astounding, too. Of course, one wonders, you know, depending on what discipline you're talking to, you know, some people think they're all drug addicts and alcoholics. And then, you know, from what you're saying, I take it that you probably think, or I'd like to know whether you think, that a lot of the reason they're in prison is because of their brain injuries.
Well,
Dr. Carroll.
Yeah, I'm astounded by the numbers also. And I remember when I first saw these numbers, and they're just amazingly overwhelming numbers. There are about 1.5 million new traumatic brain injuries in the United States every year. And again, we're so used to throwing these numbers around, and unless you compare them to other groups, you lose track of what that number means. The Brain Injury Association of Minnesota quotes about 12 to 15,000, something like that. New brain injuries in Minnesota every year. Now, again, all of those don't end up in hospitals. Some of them are milder injuries, although the joke in the healthcare system is a mild injury by definition is one that happens to somebody else, because if it's your brain that's damaged, it's not mild. So not most of them are ending up in hospitals, but still, it's an overwhelming number of people that this is happening to. You know, there are reference materials on all those numbers. The issue regarding the prison system, there's been a discussion for a long, long time about what percentage of people in prison have had brain injuries. And the thinking among providers has been that it's probably fairly high. But this study that's now just started, they've just gone through about 600 new admissions. So this is preliminary data. I'm on the advisory committee for the grant that we got to be able to do this research. There's a questionnaire that's being done with them. It's been interesting because part of the discussion has been around, will these folks admit it? Because most people don't necessarily want to admit they've had a brain injury. My suspicion is, if anything, it may be underreported rather than overreported, because it doesn't do you much good to admit that you had a brain injury if you're in prison. But we don't know yet. We'll have to see how the statistics come out in the long run. But let's say the number is overinflated by 10%. So it's 80% as opposed to 90%. It's still overwhelming numbers. I do think onset of brain injury contributes to social problems, behavioral problems, emotional problems that can increase your chance of having running afoul of the law. Again, most of the people we're treating, let me say this differently, most people with brain injury do not run afoul of the law. I don't want to imply that the program I'm running represents most people with brain injury. Most people with brain injury do not fall into the category we're talking about. But if you do, it's a major societal problem, because society will tolerate you being depressed. It will tolerate you having memory troubles. It will not tolerate you beating people up. And those are the people I save.
Representative Liebling said. Yep. Okay, Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Dr. Carroll. With your reimbursement that you get from Medicaid right now within the hospital, what percentage of that do you lose? In other words, if you get a dollar's worth of cost, what is your reimbursement rate currently within the hospital from Medicaid?
On the average, last year our payment was $936, and our cost was $700 higher than that. It's on the second handout. Our average payment was $939, which is in the lower line, and our average expense was $1,631. And again, we're not trying to address $600 a day. We're just trying to get the NBI program caught back up. There aren't a lot of cases that come through NBI every year, three or four or five, maybe, you know, on a busy year, maybe eight or nine. What hurts us is, as Representative Murphy mentioned earlier, our average length of stay for our overall hospital is 33. In this particular program, it's 200 days. So it's not the loss per day, it's the times.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Dean.
Do you have any outpatient services that you deliver?
Yes, we have an outpatient brain injury clinic where we see cases both in follow-up to our program as well as new referrals that, if we can manage on an outpatient basis, we'll try to manage them on an outpatient basis. That's staffed by a rehabilitation physician, by a psychiatrist that specializes in brain injury, by folks like me that are neuropsychologists. We also have just opened a concussion clinic to deal with some of the milder injuries from concussions.
Mr. Chair, Dr. Carroll, is there a difference in reimbursement from Medicaid from your inpatient to your outpatient groups, and is that a source of problem?
There is a difference between the inpatient and outpatient, but it's not an enormous. It's the inpatient includes the full coverage cost. It's not only the cost of the doctors and the nursing staff, but it covers the infrastructure costs like housekeeping and heating the building, administration, social work. The outpatient cost is on a per visit, and it's typically, I want to say, $300 per visit.
Mr. Chair and Dr. Kell, on Section 2 of the bill, it refers to essentially what would be designated your hospital. It's a long-term hospital designated by Medicare program located in the city of the first class in 2.25 and 2.26. Would that include any other facilities, or could it have the potentiality of including facilities other than yours?
Not because of the designation of the city in the first class, it only represents Bethesda. There are two long-term acute care hospitals in Minnesota. They're both here in the Twin Cities, Bethesda, and there's another facility over in Golden Valley. Presently, what Bethesda's payment rate is, as I mentioned, is $936 a day on the average. Based on the way the payment system works, the facility over in Minneapolis is being paid about $3,600 a day. The language was crafted this way by representatives of the Department of Human Services specifically to address Bethesda because they didn't believe that the Golden Valley facility had a problem.
And if I might add, the other facility doesn't take our kinds of patients for injury.
Representative
B. Well, Mr. Chair, just to wrap up with Representative Murphy, just from your going as you go forward, get a fiscal note. From my experience, the difference between getting the fiscal note and selection of a pope is the Cardinals are always right. So, just as you go on, my limit is.
Thank you.
Are we supposed to look for smoke signals?
Right.
Representative Rood.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you. Interesting presentation. I have two quick questions, and forgive me if I missed it. Does Bethesda serve then patients, do they come from outside of the state of Minnesota as well?
Yep.
Mr. Johnson.
Yes. We about 80 to 85% of our patients come from other hospitals. Very small number come from other states. We do receive, on the average, maybe 3 or 4 patients from mostly out of state would be Western Wisconsin. Periodically, from other states outside the area, they might go into Dr. Farrell's program because his program is so unique. Most of the other LTACs don't do brain injury services. The closest LTACs, besides the one in Golden Valley, are in Fargo, Sioux Falls, and Madison.
Thank you. And then, Mr. Chair, one of
Representative.
Thank you. Quick question. Why the increase in the brain injuries? Why are we seeing, you mentioned that there's 1.5 million new diagnoses a year. What's going on there?
I don't think that means that this year, for example, there were 1.5, and last year there were 1.2, and the year before that there were 1.1. What I'm saying is, on average, every year, it's about 1.5 million. So I don't think the number is necessarily going up. I have not looked, to be honest, I have not looked at the new number of cases as a trend over the years, but the number is staggering if it's anywhere close to that. Car accidents, sports, falls, all sorts of things.
Yeah.
I may have misspoke if I implied it's the number is going up over time. I've not looked at the trend over time. I've been doing this work for 26 years. It's probably pretty steady. I haven't seen it rise or decline.
It was just the prevalence that was so
right.
Astounding.
It's astounding. It is astounding.
We've got three people signed up for questions, so make them brief because we just got a few minutes left. Representative Gottwald. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I take it just by the fact that you've got designated by the Medicare program in here that there are some federal dollars that are involved with this request for funding from the state. Is that true?
I believe so. Our payments are generally matched 50%.
50%?
Yeah. Or dollar for dollar, I guess is the way to say it.
Okay. Mr. Chair.
Representative Anderson.
Do you get military? I see by your article here, there's an article on Mr. Eric Knudsen. Do you get quite a few military people that get referred to your hospital?
I don't know about the hospital as a whole. Thank you. I don't know about the hospital as a whole. I'm talking about my programs. We've not had a lot. We've had a couple that have been referred. Some of the Iraqi vets returning. The VA, as I understand it, is dealing with most of those. Though, again, the niche we're talking about is highly specialized, and we've been over to the VA a number of times to talk with them about the kinds of services we're providing, because this is a very specialized niche.
Thank you.
And Representative Broad.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have two quick questions. Dr. Carroll, I think. I too, was struck by the numbers of the brain injury. I'm wondering if you could just at some point, I don't need it today, but send me a link or send maybe the committee a link to some information that you think would be helpful. And also, I'm looking at demographic breakdown of those injuries. Are they happening to kids, or is it just a diagnostic change? What's going on? I too, would like that information. Then secondly, the specific question is, from what I understand, that there's already a great disparity in the rates between Bethesda and the Golden Valley facility. Do you have any information as to why that's the case currently? And you're trying to reduce the disparity with this bill. But if I understood it correctly, they have a $3,300 a day reimbursement rate, and Or did maybe I hear that incorrectly?
You're very close.
Mr. Johnson.
Under the Freedom of Information Act, we were able to obtain cost reports, and the rates are based on cost reports. The most recent cost reports that are being used are now the 2003 cost reports. And looking and reviewing their cost report, it is our best estimate that their rate is now in the $3,600 range.
The brief answer to the demographics is most injuries are happening to young people, typically 16 to the early 20s is when most traumatic brain injuries are happening, and then you have a secondary bump in the elderly who tend to fall, so slip on the ice, fall downstairs, those sorts of things for traumatic brain injury, for traumatic brain injury, and I can get you the references for the other quotes.
Representative Broad.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And maybe Representative Murphy, along the way, if you can, or maybe I'll do the research myself too, maybe we can just talk separate from here. I'm curious as to why that big disparity between the two facilities, and if you can provide that to me or we can have that discussion, I think that would be helpful as well.
Mr. Chair and Representative Broad, I'd be happy to do that.
Okay. Without objection, the bill... House File 570 will be laid over for possible inclusion in the final bill.
Thank you.
And the meeting is adjourned.